Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Brad.
Hey.
Good evening to you.
It is
my
good
friend. Brad, I think I could call you old friend now.
Yeah, cool. That's cool.
Right?
It's
We're going on a pretty long time.
It's probably like what? I actually, you know what? I was going back to some of the old episodes when I was looking for like a Flashback Friday episode. And I was actually kind of shocked that you started officially co-hosting like within our like second year, I think.
Yeah, it was early, earlier than I thought.
Yeah, earlier than I thought, for sure. Yeah.
And when I went back and saw that, I had a little more, I felt like I had a little more liberty to pick up the show.
Absolutely.
Like I've been around for a minute, you know,
dude.
Earn my stripes.
Yeah, I kind of felt like you came in the last like year and a half, but no, dude, you were there like the second year.
Yeah, old school, dog.
For real.
Everything, old school. So we got to start dropping these at the top, right? Because we are going to be sound businessmen today. We have a Patreon, right?
And it is what funds this show. As you'll notice, you didn't hear an ad at the beginning of this unless you're listening to it like 5 months from now.
Right. Before we potentially sell out. But we do fund this program through our Patreon. We post extra content. There'll be a lot from this interview on there. We post funny photos of me in masks. We write weird stuff. We have even the old unreleased episodes and videos that Brad puts up there. And of course, our Thursday night Discord fireside chat, which is an absolute pleasure.
Yep.
And we hang out in there. So if anybody has enjoyed past episodes of Going Off Track or plan on enjoying this one, please throw us a couple shekels over at the Patreon.
Patreon.com/goingofftrack.
So for this interview, I'm excited, okay?
Yeah.
This is a local unicorn, a local legend. One of these people who, when I met this human, this was a fully formed human, you know? I was like, this is a dude, this is a force. But I had no idea where he came from, what the actual story was. And I was dying to know. And I think we need to get into more stuff like this, you know, the people who actually make our industry tick.
Oh, man. For me, I love the behind the scenes stuff. I could do so many like road dog stories for sure.
Oh, yeah.
I'd love it.
So this is Matty O'Brien, New Jersey legend. He owns and operates Dogwig Printing down in Manasquan. But spent many, many years on the road with Sick of It All, with the Mighty Mighty Boss Stones, with Black Train Jack, knows the Bouncing Souls intimately and watched them, you know, form at the Commercial Ave House and take off, and was kind of the, you know, one of the right-hand men at the beginning trying to get the whole ship afloat. And he's just this fantastic storyteller, spins a lot of yarns. You won't find a person in this industry or in New Jersey who doesn't love Matty. And I thought, who better to come and co-host this show than old friend of the program, Dave Haas?
Yeah.
Who subsequently took his job from Sick of It All.
Right.
And started going out on the road just a little, you know, generation behind. But this was a lot of fun, man.
Oh, my God. And what, so good.
Good stories. I mean, I knew about Sick of It All being being tough, being New York guys, you know, having that thing. But, oh, I didn't know this much, Brad.
No, me neither.
Goodness gracious. I listened to some of it, and, you know, I have stories from my touring years that were tough and wild and pretty crazy. And I'm like, fuck, I didn't do that.
No way, dude.
That's some like next level shit.
You wouldn't survive it.
No, I feel like it's like a mixture of like a punk rock show and just like a smoky billiards hall, you know? I wouldn't have stood a chance.
No, I definitely wouldn't have stood a chance against any of these guys.
I know. This is a great interview. Thanks to Kate Hiltz and Brian Keeneland for giving me some awesome insight into the old days as usual. And thanks to Dave Haas. I did that whole interview with Dave Haas like 2 months ago and said his name wrong the entire time. So maybe I should just keep it going now.
Yeah, but he's used to it by now.
Yeah, let's get into this, because this is a long and fun interview with Matty O'Brien. It's going on
track! This guy gives me a Chevy 1988 C20 blue van, two seats up front, empty in the back.
Beautiful.
This was a dream. My life, talking about pivot in your life, was that moment. Like,
wow,
I have a van.
Yeah.
And bands are oftentimes idiots, and they can't keep it together to have a van.
Right.
And so at this point, I had met people like Ernie from Token Entry, and he had a band called Black Train Jack that lived in New York that would play a lot with Souls and play all these shows. But every time they showed up, they had a rental van.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, you guys rent a van every weekend? They're like, yeah, we rent it from Barn Rental on Northern Boulevard.
Okay.
Northern Boulevard. And and so I was like, if you guys wanted to rent my van, I would drive it and then pick you up and go to these shows. And they were like, are you kidding? It's way better than Barn. Like, it's amazing.
Yeah.
So that was how I started.
Ladies and gentlemen, he's doing Ernie Parada.
That was Ernie.
Parada,
yeah, that was an Ernie. Yeah.
It sounds exactly like the actual man that he's impersonating.
It's true.
To the point where I'll be on the phone with Matty and we'll be gabbing and he'll go into Ernie and I'll think Ernie had entered the call.
What?
It's such a dead on impression of Ernie.
I have one question for you, my friend.
Which is never true. It's 700.
It's so many questions. Rapid fire. Forget any of your questions. You're just going to answer. You're only going to answer Ernie's questions, and then he's going to say, all right, look, send me a text. I got to go. All right.
I got to go.
But so I'd made a couple of these connections, and then I guess proven my value to be like a guy who was dependable to drive you and carry your gear and just, you know, carry equipment and we're all in the pretense of like, I like going to the shows. I want to be at these shows I didn't really have money. So this is a way to get to shows. This is a way to go other places.
Well, it's funny. Yeah. It almost sounds like you found value in being like the person who's not fucked up and being the one who can keep their shit together a little bit.
This was sort of like a built-in value that, you know, being dependable and being sober taking it seriously. I don't know if it was a job, but still taking it seriously to say, okay, it's my van. Like, I took me a while to get to this point. I have a van, like I drive it. It's not carrying on all the time. And those guys were, you know, with Ernie and with Black Train Jack, there was not a partying van and vehicle and stuff. Were like, but they were like serious musicians and these shows were pretty good and all over, you know, southeastern Pennsylvania and down to DC and up to that, you know, Connecticut and Boston. And
they were like a bigger band than the Souls?
They were like neck and neck, you know.
Okay, okay.
Like,
gotcha.
There was places that the Souls were definitely bigger. And then, but like Ernie had the Token Entry lead in. And so there was like all these places scattered across Pennsylvania these little shows in Phoenixville's and Havertown's, and you know, you're like, they love us here. You know, he'd be like, they love us here. And so you'd go there and there'd be, you know, 400 kids to see Black Train Jack, and then they would bring souls, and then, you know, it would feed off each other and stuff. But like City Gardens, it seemed like, you know, souls kind of had a leg up in the Jersey thing. And then all of that same time, 92, 93-ish, like the city sort of emerged from its weird, like punk and hardcore being violent and gross, and CBs wouldn't really have you play and stuff like that, into like, okay, Continental is a place that has cool small shows.
And right.
Then Coney Island started to,
sure,
took a couple years, and CBs would have shows, and there was a place called the Grand, which had been the Cat Club, and there were a lot of venues to play where it was kids coming into the city from Jersey and coming in from,
right,
Long Island and coming in from, you know, Westchester, different places, and to see bands. And
right.
So it's sort of,
I was one of them. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure you were. Like, that would be the right time to be like, these are young kids coming in to shows, 16 and over.
I'd like to say, you know, you're talking about this rebirth in New York, and I'd like to think it was probably my friends and I who did it.
It definitely was. No. I'm 100%.
By attending shows at 14 years old. Yeah.
That's when Benny came to the city.
Yeah.
Benny cruised in.
You're welcome, New York City.
He took notes. He said, I'm going to take some notes on this, and I'm going to go back and start booking.
That's right.
Shows.
That's exactly, right.
Which you did. So
it's true.
So there was, you know, some of this, and I guess those bands in New York, like, you know, the post-hardcore bands were kind of happening, Quicksand, right, shit like, yeah, that. So there was shows. There were shows like that to be, you know, the bands, those Black Train would support, and kind of, there was momentum there.
So it wasn't almost as if like all these bands, you know, you were friends with, like Souls and Black Train Jack and all them. It's almost not like they got bigger. It's like just the scene got bigger. The availability got bigger, and they went with it because they were there already.
Yeah. There started to be more, I guess, you know, it was a building momentum, and then, you know, that the city was not in that weirdo looking for the next Jane's Addiction thing, you know, all A&R people drinking at Pyramid Club it was like, oh, there's just 200 kids outside of CBGB's on a Sunday to see Mind Over Matter and Bouncing Souls and,
right,
you know, these other bands. So it gained momentum.
Was there a change in those guys and like the Souls and Black Train Jack and those, you know, were they seeing their path as maybe more legitimate and possible when that started happening?
Yeah. Like the Souls in 93-ish, the Souls adopted, you know, they called Discord, and they called the Sterns at BYO, and they might have called 7 Seconds, like Kevin Seconds.
Okay.
And we're like, okay, Positive Force, BYO, Discord, like, what should we do? You know, we have to like galvanize in some way.
Okay.
And so they were, and maybe the Sterns called them back, you know, and Ian was probably like, you better just do it yourself, you know? They knew they were on their own path. We're going to press a record. We're going to save our money. We're going to press this record that we own. You know, maybe they'd already done the green one, and then they were moving on to the those 7 inches, the Argyle 7-inch and shit like that. Like, we'll pay to record. We will press the record. We'll have 2,000 of them. We play to that many people over a couple months. We'll sell them all. We have a van. We can do it, you know. And Black Train Jack kind of had a little bit of a different thing, that they went from like a couple demo tapes, and then bam, they were signed to Roadrunner.
Right.
Yeah. And it was like, oh, this is going to, we're on a label. There's, you know, everyone, of course, everyone.
We were signed to Roadrunner.
Roadrunner called right away. And Howie Abrams was at Roadrunner. And I said, we are going on tour. That we are going places. Things are going to happen. So, and those guys, you know, Ernie was the veteran of the whole thing a little bit. He had been signed to Roadrunner before, took an entry. So this,
he claims, I gotta just interject here, just because, yeah, I don't know that this is the best interjection, but Ernie claims, when he's telling this part of the story, Black Train Jack's like sort of rise, he claims that they were so red hot that I would turn my amplifier on. The red light would go on. We'd be in Florida. No one lives in Florida. No one's ever heard of the place. I would turn my amplifier on in 1993 and the crowd would go wild. And I'm so, you know, and this is when I met Ernie, I'm wrapped. I'm like, well, okay, tell me everything.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You've been to Florida.
I'm like, I think people know where Florida is, Ernie, but all right. Yeah, but it's not New York City. Yeah. That's a dump. I didn't even know why we were there.
If you're from Queens.
The crowds were ready. Yeah, right. Yeah. This is a man who still lives in the same house.
Yeah, lives shouting distance across the alley from the house he always lived in. Like,
that's right. That's my mother's house.
They consider New Jersey the American mainland, like Manhattan is island.
Totally.
And you only really went there to go to Disneyland, like to go to as and if someone you knew went to college in Connecticut, like otherwise there's no point to leave those islands, you
know? So anyway, I would turn my amplifier on and the crowd would go nuts, and then Green Day happened.
It all
vanished. We were an afterthought. And he tells it in such a way, you're hanging on every word. And in Ernie's mind, like, the only thing that separated Black Train Jack from being the Foo Fighters
was Green Day
came along.
Green Day snuck in there and stole the
They thing. Snuck in there, and suddenly they were a little younger.
Yep.
I'm like, they wrote really good songs. Yeah. Right? Yeah. Well, they were okay. Yes, yeah, they were okay. But it was more of that California thing.
Yep.
And Queens was out the door.
There was no one cared. His big brother.
Yeah, oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah. That's what it'll tell you. Then no one cared. No, I went to get a job. That's it. Yep,
that's it. I went and got a job. His rub with that whole thing was they were playing the style of music that they were playing, which I guess would fall into like pop punk.
These days, yeah. I mean, it didn't exist in that format yet. But
yeah. In 1992, that's in that period, pre-Dookie, Green Day.
Yeah.
But you were playing alongside of Demise and Biohazard,
right?
These are the other bands on your label and shit. You're playing at Studio One in Newark, and
your best friends are Murphy's Law, like,
yeah, right. You stood out, like, you stood out, like, oh my god, this guy actually has a melody. There's the three chords make sense, you know, and so
he's super young and cute.
Oh, just positive energy. We're not trying to kill anybody.
Right.
And so this, but then unbeknownst to him somehow that, you know, all these things were happening in California and stuff. Not that he's uninformed.
Now, where is California? That's out west or what?
You go
through New York.
When you go through the Holland Tunnel and just go straight, and then there's San Francisco. That's it. Oh, wait. Right in the middle is Peg Boy, Chicago. Unbelievable. That's it.
Unbelievable.
And you go all the way there, and then there's Social Distortion and Descendants. It's very good.
Yeah, very good.
Very good. We played The Farm in San Francisco. We played The Farm, and we played Fender's Ballroom. We did, and people went crazy, you know?
We did $1,200 in merch.
Yeah. So, and then, so it was sort of, you know, he had a very people from Queens have a very myopic look at things. Like, if it's not happening in New York, it couldn't be happening. And
he still thinks that. He still thinks that rooting for the Sixers or rooting for the Nets is like, why would you do that when you can root for New York?
Yeah. The Knicks are going to be a 500 team. They're going to be 500. And you're like, hey, Aaron, the Sixers have been leading the East the entire season. Second best record in the league.
Why would you root for the Sixers?
If three more wins, the Knicks could be 500. It's unbelievable. Yeah. Everyone loves this team.
I grew up with people raised in Queens, and I can confirm. I mean, Manhattan to them. That was a trip.
Yeah.
Right. That was the weekend. You know what I mean? It was like going over the bridge.
We are going into the city.
Yeah, we're going for cheesecake in Brooklyn. You know? Yeah,
the same thing is true for Craig Sitari from Sick of It All. Like, yes. I have a couple friends that hail from Queens, the Sick of It All guys, Ernie, and they still, I mean, maybe not the rest of Sick of It All, but Craig is a similar type of he has a similar approach to other cities. He's like, well, Philadelphia, that's not a real place, is it? I mean, you know, and I'm like, dude, it's the only, like, you can't start a band in New York in 2020 or like,
how can you even afford to live in New York?
Yeah, it costs too much money. Like, Philly's a real place. That's not a real place, kid. It's just funny, these older guys that still, you know, because they lived and survived and maintained a life in New York, they still think
it's the world revolves around New York.
No, listen, right. I don't even, I was born in New Jersey and I'm raised by people like that. Yeah. And I still basically think like that.
Sure. Do you really?
Oh, dude, that's interesting. I mean, especially concerning Philadelphia, David. We've had a lot of talks about that. We've had a couple chats.
Yeah, I know. You are only one generation away from that same thinking. It's interesting. Like that it New is? York is,
yeah.
is, you know, because if you think about it, even culturally, now I may be stepping in a giant pile of shit here, but New York, what has New York really brought? In terms of like a music scene, like nothing for a long time. We're talking about like 20 years.
I mean,
since the Strokes and the National and all that, like that would probably be like the last rock thing, right?
I mean, maybe rock, you know, but there's a lot of,
but obviously hip hop and stuff.
LCD right, sound but, system.
Yeah. But I just mean as a cultural hub, like what it's.
Well, all culture flows through New York at some point, you know,
it's, at some point. Yeah. But it doesn't, it long past are the days where like a scene is generated and blows up in New York. It's kind of financially almost impossible now.
But is that happening everywhere? You know, I think that's a fallout of, you know, digital internet culture as well. Because even Maddie just talked about it, you know, maybe 10 minutes ago, this idea, Black Train Jack was a big up and coming band. And to them, getting out of the city and doing well was to take a trip to fucking Haverford, Pennsylvania with Maddie.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that was the scope. And like, idea that everything stays like, you know, much more local and authentic in that way. And the idea that, you know, you can be 14 years old, put your song on YouTube, you know, talk to kids from Los Angeles. Like before you know it, you're not even in your scene. You're not even in your home. Town,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And every city in America is being gentrified like fuck. So
exactly. Like this is true for San Francisco. It's true for most of LA. That's
Nashville.
Yeah.
It's like
and Philly. You know, I've heard a bunch of people go, I can't even fucking go to Fishtown anymore.
Right. No, that's totally true. And that'll be the next thing. But I just was more commenting on how these men, you know, even in the last 10 years, the Ernie or Craig or any of these older guys to us, they still think like, you can't root for the Nets. The Knicks are right here. It's like, the world changed. It changed, dude. It's not all about, you know, the whole world is not really revolving around the Empire State.
I've literally met people who quit liking baseball when the Brooklyn Dodgers left.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean,
right.
They still haven't gotten over it.
No, they never will. They'll die.
It's hard. You can't tell them like that. You'll get into a problem if you tell them that the Giants actually play in New Jersey.
But that's the media. You go like, "Here, welcome to Giant Stadium," and then you just see a picture of the New York skyline.
Yeah, I'm exactly.
Like, come on, you're in fucking Sea Caucus. Let's be
honest. Over there, and you're in the fucking you're in the swamp.
You're in the swamp. Right. Jimmy Hoffa's right there. Like, come on, let's be real.
The Sopranos go-go bar is right up the street.
All right, Maddie, I got to ask you this question before we get too far. So we're talking about these really influential, interesting bands that are really important to people. And, you know, over the years, even with your business and touring, you've watched a ton of bands come and go. And from your seat, I wonder what you think are kind of the fundamentals to successful bands. Like, what do the good ones do to make it happen and to keep it going? And what are the markers of the bad ones and the ones who can't?
Well, what I've learned, I guess at this more advanced age, is the good ones, the people that figure out that they can create music together happily and not have to be every minute absorbed or wrapped up in each other's lives is a key. Because these bands that, and my concept of a band, maybe from living with the Souls, was you're basically a band and a gang and a family and brothers, and everything has to happen together, and you all work on it together, and everyone's input is equal, and all this shit. And then coming to realize, like, a band can be, you know, a guy or two guys who write really good songs, and then a bunch of musicians who come in and say, I'm thrilled to be in this band because I can do my thing as a musician with them. The good ones probably, they work hard. They don't take themselves too, you know, at a point you can't take yourself too seriously. Like, right. this is some shit I made up. I hope you like it, you know? And this will be for the next 2 hours. This is going to cost you $65 for the next 2 hours of your life to listen to me do some shit that I made up. But
that would be like that model you just described. You probably saw that in like the Boss Tones, right? Where when you worked for them, you're like, okay, this isn't necessarily a gang. This is a couple guys are running this with. It's more of like an enterprise, I guess, right? When you work for them,
you get to see it. Well, like early on, when I first encountered the Boss Tones and was on tour with them, as with Black Street Jack, and then getting the job to work with them, and they seemed very coalesced around that sort of we're all together in this idea, we all work. But coming to learn that not everybody wrote the songs, and it was, you know, there was a sort of a brain trust, and Gittleman and Nate and Dickie were really the driving force, you know, but Joe was an amazing drummer, and the horns were also very important. Like everything that came in there was, and they always, the equitable treatment that they gave each other always seemed to work really well. Not elevating one person really too far, any one person too far above the others, whether right. It would be that they were the front man or the songwriter or the ripping guitar guy or, you know, whatever. So my understanding of a band had to change from being young to now and to be like, well, who puts out the music? Who puts out good music that I like, or who continues to put out good music that I like? You know, you definitely have to have as a songwriter or a musician, you have to have a passion for it. Like I said, don't take yourself too seriously. Work at it, and you got a shot. You know, like, but going way back to in the beginning, it was like you should have good gear. You should right. get yourself some good gear. You should get yourself a van. Like, you should be prepared. If that phone rings and someone says, come play, you and your guy should be ready to go. Like, that was what I saw as a young person. And so that attitude mattered for what I saw, you know, for like people that were other bands that maybe got passed by on opportunities that were like, well, we can only tour in the summer. We can do, you know, I'm
right. Right.
I'm college. Yeah. You know? And it was like, oh, why is this band's great, but people don't get to see them, or they don't want to tour that much. Or, you know, one guy thinks that they should be making way more money than the other.
Right.
And so,
right.
It really, you know, but ultimately for the music that I enjoy now, and what bands do, and I'm like a bad example because I'm not current with anything buying records. Like, my Spotify, I don't even know password. Like, you know, I hear a lot of music from other people at work and shit, but I am not like up to date on anything.
Well, you still hire eager young punks, so I'm sure there's still some.
Luckily, a good portion of my life, my musical knowledge has been bolstered by people that were willing to work in here with us and had a better CD collection or a better iPod.
That being said, now what's a kiss of death? What's something like you see or hear from a band where in your head you're like, all right, good luck to you, but not happening.
I mean, I probably have, I probably for a long time had a very stringent set of rules, you know, like, do not be on stage wearing fucking flip-flops and right. you know, do not, like a lot of appearance things and,
sure.
you know, shit that would be corny or, you know, I mean, early on, I was like, if you are not playing a Les Paul, like, and you, if you don't have a, you know, a JMP Marshall, like if you have a solid state amplifier, like get the fuck out of here. You know, like which is like certainly in the world of hardcore, and you're like, I have to take this guy seriously. He's got a single coil pickup plugged into a 50 amp crate amplifier. It sounds like my fucking toaster on overdrive, and this is supposed to be heavy music. Like, get this Charvel Jackson shit out of here, and please get at least fucking save your money and get an Epiphone Les Paul knockoff, you know, get a fucking humbucker. But
humbucker.
I've come to learn that you can do, you know, you soften as you get older in the middle and other places, that you like music that wouldn't appeal to me, and I'd be like, oh, that's so whack and that's corny and you know, these, who's doing that, or I can't believe they go on stage like that, or can't believe, you know, I was like, oh, Rancid is like headlining a beer garden festival. I'm like, it's like 3/4 sober guys or 4 sober guys. I don't know. You know, like guys that have long since moved away from alcohol, and they're the headliner of the brewery craft brew world tour fucking festival thing. I was like, yeah, it's kind of a weird mix, you know?
Yeah.
But I've kind of dropped all that shit. Like, I don't care. I'm like, what am I going to care? Like, you know, I see, I mean, and stuff that doesn't appeal to me in music, in I guess popular music, and the Takeshi 6ix9ines and shit. Like, I don't even understand. I couldn't believe that for 1 minute more than 10 people would pay attention to this. And then I'm like, oh, that looks like there's 200,000 people in the crowd at that show.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I've sort of dropped my filter down to very low, and I've opened my ears to say, if something comes on and I like the sound of it, I'm
just go with that.
I just go with it, you know. And then somebody tells me like, oh, that's a Blink 182 from their B-side compilation song. And I'm like, oh, was never really, you know, I never really cared for that group for whatever reason. That's a good song, you know.
Right.
Like, I mean, when I grew up,
likely performed in flip flops.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. You know?
In a bucket. Written, recorded, and performed in flip flops.
Yeah.
Many open toed shoes.
Oh, God. This whole, like, and this is the other thing. Like, growing up without the internet and without social media, you know, so you didn't see all this shit.
Right.
The amount of things that you saw was still photos, Rolling Stone or Thrasher magazine, and very little, you know, some MTV shit. At times, and so limited outlets, fanzines and stuff. So you would have, like, it shocks me if I scroll through Instagram and you know, punk videos, punk rock videos, at punk rock videos, whatever account has Rancid playing a outdoor show, and Tim Armstrong has like a Gilligan's hat from Gilligan's Island on, you know, and I'm like, you know, I kind of like lumped Bucket Hats in with Smash Mouth in my mind.
Yeah.
But there's an amazing songwriter of my generation who's certifiably platinum in his punk rock world up there in a bucket hat, you know, a haggard ass bucket hat, you know, tired ass Bob Denver's leftover bucket hat. But so
maybe he got it from the guy from Smash Mouth.
Probably took it right off him.
Got some nice lures on there, bud.
Exactly. Yeah. So my filter is way down. You couldn't see all these things, but growing up, you know, you would say like a band like Face to Face, you know, was on Fat Records and came out, and you're like, these songs are very well constructed, very audibly pleasing songs. And everyone said, these fucking white trash dudes are from Bakersfield, Victorville, California, and they were all heavy metal dudes. Hmm. And you're like, well, we can't like them, you know?
Right.
You're like, but this, I cannot get, I've been driving for 2 hours and the song is stuck in my head, you know? And
yeah.
You're like, oh, why? What's my problem? Like the guy, you know, oh, now he's like a Fred Flintstone version of Mike Ness, but Well, what am I looking? What's fucking me up here? It's me that's fucking me up with my eyes and not right. my ears. You know,
right, right.
I could just keep driving to Chicago and humming along to that. You
Take
know,
this song.
Yeah, fuck it. You know, so
right. You're supposed to like some horrible third-rate straight-edge band from Connecticut.
Oh,
that's what you're supposed to like in the van. But what you really like is that face-to-face record.
Yeah,
or yeah,
whatever. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
I found that to be such a weird thing with punk that. You know, the songs are undeniable, as we can all agree on that.
Sure.
And, you know, to me, with music in general, it's always like, well, who writes a song that sticks in my head? Who writes a song that's compelling, et cetera? And all those rules, you know, it was so bizarre to me. Like, this band sucks. I get why you guys are all, you think you're supposed to like jump on top of each other to like this.
Yeah, yeah.
This one particular straight edge thing or whatever, fill in the right. blank.
Yeah.
But the band is terrible.
Right.
Right.
And that always bugged me that you know, that those rules existed because they really did back then. Like now it's less so.
It's a free for all now.
Well, yeah. We're also old. Like I think we all
right.
got over it. You know
right.
what I mean?
Sure.
At some point,
Let's hope.
It's like
yeah.
the same reason why every punk rock kid has like a copy of On the Road in their book collection. Like,
of course,
not
yeah.
that good of a book. Guy died being a white trash guy who hated Jews. Like,
right.
Like, but enjoy this on your collection. Like, everybody.
Yeah, yeah. We have to, these staples that we have
yeah,
to.
Yeah, like all yeah. these rules. So many rules.
Yeah. And that
was more rules than I could even, you know, the whole thing was no rules. And you get in there and you're like, oh, it's only rules.
It was all rules. I mean, and then yeah. you, because these scenes were so narrow, they were small. Yeah. And then you could be like, oh, this is narrow. Like,
yeah.
If a band like, God, you know, Hoover shows up in New Brunswick in 1992, and these guys all had fucking beards like Abraham Lincoln, you know, and I was like, no beards, no fucking beards. Like, I don't know what the fuck, you know, was going on. And like Chuck Reagan and Hot Water hadn't made it safe for beards, you know, or Avail hadn't made it safe for beards yet. But I was like, what the fuck, you know, and they're like, so you're using the wrong part of your brain to like, narrow these things out. And
I wonder, what were you associating beards with at the time? Like old cinnamons and rippers?
I couldn't even grow one. It was like, it was an impossibility, you know? And I was like, oh, a guy with a fucking beard? Like, what's wrong? Just fucking shave your face. You know, like,
none of the bands you're describing, like Black Train Jack, Bouncing Souls, and Boss Tones, not a single beard. There are a few goatees maybe, but not a single full
that's
beard.
True. Oh, wow. I think we're pinpointing something here with Maddie.
No.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Steinkopf has that greasy beard thing. That he's
oh,
got.
He got a beard.
You're
now.
A fucking baby yeah. facist.
Oh, back then. Yeah, there was no, I mean,
let's dude, cancel dude, Maddie. He hates beards.
One quick razor and boop, boop, and you're okay, done. Like, and Keeneland would do a nice, like, chop, like a fancy beard, you know, like a chin strap. Like, these were things that happened in over that time. Like, goatee, of course, like goatees, sick of it all, and goatees are inseparable, oh, yeah. you know.
You
and,
need
and
a like, soul patch to be in sick
yeah,
of it all, yeah.
House of Pain, like you had this, and you're like, okay, so goatees kind of go with like tough New York, okay, got it. And then,
yeah.
you know, or like chin strap beard, like sick of it all had a concept, like if you had that beard, that thin line beard that went down along your jawline and around and then back up,
uh-huh.
that it was like you had a detachable face, like you could. You could, you know, it was like one of those plastic masks you could take off at that beard line, you know?
Take it from me. There's only one reason people do that. The trench strap is very slimming. Okay. It's
That's
very
it.
Slimming.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's good for a chubby face. I did it for years.
It delineates the chin area
yeah.
from the
Just
neck.
Just take it out yeah. of the equation. Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, speaking of that crew, can you?
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about when you were working the Sick of It All job?
Yes.
And you handed it over to young David here.
Oh, okay.
Now, what was that? Like, why did you trust young David? What was his vibe back then?
I want to back up a little bit and just say that there was a small crew between.
Little interim, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Maddie's tenure and mine.
I punted and it took a minute for Dave to pick up the ball.
That's right. I had to get through high school.
Yeah. Well, and that beer distributor.
job. Yeah, that's right. The beer distributor, fondue manager, yeah. You know.
Right.
I had to get through a few of those to land at the illustrious
guitar tech. Sick of it all.
No, I started as drum tech.
Drum tech.
Now, I still know four things about the drums, and that's just each of their names. You know, kick drum, snare drum.
Snare drum.
But right. Here I was cymbal. Drum tech.
Could you quick question. Could you pronounce the brand of the cymbal?
Can I?
Yeah.
Zildjian.
Okay.
Right?
It sounds good to me. I mean, Benny's a drummer. He can confirm.
Yeah, that works.
And what's the other one that begins with a P?
Peisty.
Okay. Well, as I came into the Sick of It All job, 90, Black Train Jack skidded out into real life. Ernie got married and stuff. And there was no – he was not comfortable with being on tour as a way to make an income. And
another quick aside, why would you want to go play
for money
anywhere but New York City on a Friday night?
This is insane.
He asked me this one time. You're telling me you want to be there in Germany, Hamburg, or whatever the hell, on a Friday night? You could be home.
It is so far from your home. You couldn't
be farther from your home.
You could not even watch Seinfeld reruns. I do not understand.
You realize when you get into the conversations with Ernie like this, that you're just coming from such a different perspective, even though you're friends and even though you have a deep love for one another, you're like, this guy thinks about things different for me. Cause I'm like, yo, we get to be here. This is Cologne.
You should
Cologne,
have
Cologne. It's not even a real place.
You should
That's
have
not a place.
You should have Ernie on for sure.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Sounds bad.
What do you want to talk to me for?
I'll listen in you might have to have a panel, but
very negative. And
it would quickly dispute the fact that any of these things that we said are true.
I never said any of that.
Are you crazy? So Sick of It All, I got the job. I got the job. It segued nicely off of a Black Train Jack tour opening for Sick of It All.
That's what they do. They poach openers' roadies.
They approved of my work ethic and coming, you know, a couple months later said, we need another guy to come work for us because Toby is not going to tour with us anymore. He's going to start or commit himself to his group. H2O. And so I'm like, okay, you know, and so everybody kind of moved up the ladder. I got the merch job and the guy who had the merch job, TS, had moved up to become the drum tech. And so immediately, like, I learned all these things about the former roadies that had been there. Toby was one of them. And that he had a hard he had a difficult time pronouncing Zildjian, and often having to say, I left all the Zanians at the show yesterday.
Isn't that one of those famous Toby stories that he once, not only did he forget the drum kit, but he left it set up at the club.
I can't. I cannot.
He left an entire drum kit set up at the previous.
I cannot confirm on that, but I knew that there was a struggle with the pronunciation. I mean, the way they write the word is on the things is difficult, but it was
Zanian. Good.
So yeah, so he struggled.
Emphatically, it looks nothing like Zanian.
Yeah. Well, through his eyes, he took a different look. But he got out of there and blazed his own path to success in another way. Didn't have to worry about what was doing with the drums. And so Dave, you had big shoes to fill coming in as a drum tech.
Yeah, all I had to do was not leave them at the club.
Pretty good.
Just get them into the van.
How old were you, Dave, when that happened?
How old was I when Toby left them behind?
Or like when you picked
when
up
you got the gig?
No, I'm kidding. I was I must have been 22, something like that. And and I knew Maddie via at that point he was already successfully printing shirts, so he was to me, like I had that band Step Ahead that Benny, you gave us a couple shows there in Jersey, and then I knew that Maddie printed shirts for real bands. Like he printed shirts for the Bouncing Souls and Sick of It All, and they thanked him. This was back when the thanks list was like your key into the world. Yeah. You'd read
who
did they thank and this and that. Well, I knew Dogwig was a t-shirt printer. So we at least had enough fans to print a couple dozen shirts, and that's who I called. And
beautiful Maddie, Ben Franklin design flyer.
That's right. We had colors, Ben Franklin flipping you off, step ahead, you know, this, and this sold like hotcakes in the era of the work shirt.
Yeah.
He had those work shirts back in the day.
It's right. A hot thing.
And so anyway, I connected with him there, and he took,
we also knew, we knew, I mean, you were in Philly, and so Kid Dynamite, Dr. Dan.
That was just after that. Yeah. So right after Step Ahead ordered up those shirts, we probably broke up or played a few shows with Kid Dynamite or something. Right in that same zone, I became friendly with Yeeman, who Maddie knew through
Lifetime.
And Kid Dynamite was really tearing things up, and I was their t-shirt guy. And they were also playing with Sick of It All. So it was this really pretty small world. Mm. But to me, Maddie was this like seasoned veteran. At that point, you were either quitting the Boston's to work totally on Dogwig, or you were, because this is probably 2000.
I was done.
1999. Right. So you were done.
My last tour was 1998. Well, right. I then won out of retirement, John, but I had finished touring in 1998. I did a whole year with the Boston's, and so really from like 92, getting in my own van in 92 to wrapping it up in 1998, after going to South America, was touring the world with the Boston's, and then going to South America was Sick of It All. And I was like, I have this t-shirt thing that's kind of happening. I should probably go work for myself. Like, I can carry this luggage, band luggage, forever, but it's not going to help me out that much.
Benny, you remember the barrier of entry when you're in high school bands, and you know, it was tough. Like, I didn't know any way in. Right. I knew at that point, to me, like, Maddie, I'm talking to him on the phone and trying to order up t-shirts. You know, I don't know my head from a hole in the ground.
I probably had like two pairs of free Vans given to me. Like, it must have seemed like
No, you're being too modest. I mean, from my perspective, like, you had been at the Eye of the Bouncing Souls early hurricane, and then you were working for Sick of It All at their peak, which to me is like a Philly hardcore kid. I thought, like, I didn't realize that the Troc was probably as big as they had gotten in America. Like, to me, I thought they were as big a band as you could conceive of.
For
and then
hardcore
the Boston's, you were out with the Boston's, which to me was like, and I think your last tour, was that when they really blew up? Like, they had the radio hit and stuff?
Yeah, I had to condense it real quick. So I got the Sick of It All job when Scratch the Surface, they had maybe done one tour for Scratch the Surface. So I was on that cycle of touring, you know, for another like 13 months or something. And then they paused and started to work on the Built to Last record. And I was exposed to the Boston's earlier in 93, 94 with opening with Black Train Jack. They had actually offered me a guitar tech job then that I turned down because I drive the van and carry shit. Like, I tune the guitar. Like, I'm not a guitar tech. And they were like, you should work for us. Our guy's having a baby. Like, come work for us. Like, and I didn't do it. I was entrenched with loyalty with Ernie and shit. And I was like, this is where I got to be. And I said, I'd be here. So, but they would call periodically and be like, oh, a fucking guitar tech's flaking out. Like, what are you doing next year? And I'm like, oh my God, Sick of It All's taking a year off to write a record. I'm there. Like, boom. And I would jump onto this Boston's gig, and then it would be winding down. I'd be like, oh, the uncertainty of my next thing. I guess I have this part-time shirt gig, and I will clean the toilets at the Melody and, you know, and do like fill in bar back shifts. And then like, I got so lucky. The cycles were just opposite. And then, you know, Boston's finish, and they were like, we're going to make a record, which ended up being that Let's Face It record. And I got in, Sick of It All goes, we're hitting the road. It's time for, Built to Last record, Good Looking Out, here we go, jump back over there. And then the end of 1997 was the sort of the end of that cycle for Sick of It All, and we were finishing a tour with Misfits, Jerry's Misfits, and H2O had come across the country, finishing up at Christmas time at a freezing fucking cold Birch Hill nightclub. I distinctly remember Kyle Rogg and Kate coming to the show together, standing outside freezing. and then getting, being like, fuck, I'm like a couple days later in South Carolina, like, this is the last show. And my, my beeper went off with a 617 number. And okay. And then I called back and it's Boss Tones being like, we're going to Australia in January. And our guy, we just fired the guitar tech. And I was like, yeah. So what time do I have to be at the airport? Right. Boom. So I spent that year of 98 touring internationally with the Boss Tones, which was sort of the second half of that, let's face it, gigantic. That's the big impression that I get. Single. And they had done like extensive American touring in 97. And then they
post Dickie sort of and Clueless.
Yeah. Yeah. We moved past Clueless. That was like the big Boston, like my first round with the Boston was like Someday, I Suppose, was like that big, that punch him out, big hit. And then I got to this, came back around on this trip and I was like, whoa, Someday, I Suppose is small potatoes.
Man. Yeah, sure.
It's fucking. So we did like all the international touring in 98, which was Australia and Japan and Europe extensively and England and round and round, and then mixed in with like high dollar college spring break shows and flying Top of the Pops, like all this, like kind of hit a level. I was like, wow, I would never thought like for carrying a guitar, I would ever have been here. And where do I go from here? Like Elton John, Bill Joel was going to call. Garden. I kind of had formulated that I was going to wrap it up at 98. And the t-shirt thing was going a little bit at that point. So that was the encompassment. So Dave came in a little bit after. After that, it was handed to a couple other gentlemen, gave it a crack. And then they were fortunate enough to find a young Philly rat, David Hobbs, availability.
Which Maddie sort of took pity on me or a liking or whatever it was back then. And to me, these were stars. You know, these were bands that I bought tickets to both nights when they played the Troc, you know, Sick of It All, Boss Tones, the Bouncing Souls, like all of them. I was like, holy shit, like this guy worked for them. That means he knows Helmet. He knows Rancid. He knows, like, my young mind from, you know, 18 to 20, that was what I was super into. And so Maddie sort of showed me the ropes and was like, look, here's how it works. You know, you're sharp enough to get it, and you're sharp enough to kind of keep up with the comedic gymnastics of Sick of It All or whatever. Yeah. But Maddie also told me at one point, like, hey, if you have an opportunity to get out of there and work for the Souls, which presented itself again, that shared bus situation happened where Sick of It All and the Souls shared a bus. I was working for Sick of It All, and which was great. I love to make fun and tease those guys, but I learned a lot and had a great time working for Sick of It All. But
the best,
getting the opportunity to work with the Souls was just, I mean, that changed my life. And Maddie was a person that I sought counsel. I was like, hey, what do you think? You know, you're buds with them and you worked for Sick of It All. Like, you kind of know both these camps. And he was like, look, there's nothing like the Bouncing Souls. Like, it's a family. It's totally different. They'll never not look out for you. And then that was true, you know? And so to not only get like the nudge from Maddie to go work for Sick of It All, but also the nudge to leave and go work for the Souls was like really critical. And, you know, we've remained friends. He's printed shirts for every band and musical thing that I've done tons of stuff. And then just also, you know, for me, like Maddie has kind of been a mentor in different ways too, in that like, he's much older, of course. But he's a businessman
just into fifth decade, 50 years old.
Yes. Wow. Freshly 50. Birthday. But a guy, you know, a guy that I could call at different points when opportunities would come along, you know, record contracts like I own my own little business as a songwriter and as a performer and stuff. So I can bounce ideas off of him. And so that's been a really interesting, like at this point, 20 years or something that we've known one another. I mean, that was 1996 when I probably first called looking for those Ben Franklin shirts.
Yeah. I was in a garage putting them shits up one Wednesday night. Like, okay, I have a job. I have to do 36 shirts. When should I start? Yeah.
36 pieces.
I'm going to start after Jeopardy. 6 months. I'm going to watch Jeopardy. Then I'm going to go down the stairs and print those shirts.
We probably gave away 14.
Beautiful.
And sold another 11 or whatever that math is. I don't know.
Maybe tossed a few that are in Adolf's parents' closet.
Right. Yeah. Right.
One thing about Sick of It All and getting that gig and I mean, they were larger than life to me coming up as a kid and going to shows and like the what I
Craig currently is
mind those teeth
teeth are still larger than life,
so and they were like to me it was just the pinnacle of New York hardcore, you know, a lot of the bands had broken up and had faded off and I was like, this is they had the coolest fucking logo and you're like these guys and they were like it was like having four of the coolest big brothers you could ever have.
When you were going out with them, like what's like a singular moment or a singular happening where this thing really just stood out to you like that?
Well, from the very beginning, like one of the first gigs that I worked selling merch for them was a show at the Limelight. Mm-hmm. So it had to be like, it was either it must have been the very beginning of 1995, and the Limelight would occasionally have these shows.
Right.
And I can't remember who the fuck opened, but they were on the Scratch the Surface. Scratch the Surface had come out. And so they'd done a little bit of touring in the US before that. And so here's this big ass New York show, and the fucking place is just packed with people, and there are like multitude of attractive fucking cool women at the thing. Like, and Sick of It All like knows how to greet people and say hello and kiss women on the cheek and they have fucking hair cuts that are nice, you know? Like they're like I'm like, holy shit, this isn't some fucking dirtbag like I'm a Jersey dirtbag. Like, and these guys, and then
they were like the mob. They felt like the mob.
Dude,
or
it
something.
Was like five Robert De Niro's, even though there's only four of them. It's like, and like, fuck, man. And so I was selling the merch, and like, they were like grooming me for this merch job. Like, you have to understand, like, when we go to Europe, it's going to be 10 times busier than this. You might have to get a gun. You might like get a pair of handcuffs and a briefcase that you can lock to your wrist. Like all these. And I was like, all right, yeah, fuck, whatever I got to do. Like, I was like, and no one, it doesn't even matter. Like, if you have to work and you work all day and you sell all this shit and then you get order more and you put all the money in this box and no one will fuck with you because you got five fucking Robert De Niro killers in the body of four people that are fucking, and they're just destroying, they're on stage destroying fucking as a hardcore band. Like, I was like, that was like the first moment, you know, like, holy shit. But, and so from a working standpoint, a visual standpoint, a music standpoint, and like these guys hit the stage with fucking on fire times a million, you know, and the whole place, like, you're like, oh shit, like this is New York hardcore in New York right now. And it matters. It still matters. You know, this is not a fucking reunion. This is not this other weird shit. This is not some only play the fucking 7-inch. Like, nope, this is happening and it's blowing minds and fucking people want it. Like, this is like cool people are here, you know, like
right.
This place is packed.
Also, just like for context, it, back then when that was happening, it felt every bit like we thought that was going to blow up in the same way grunge did.
Yeah,
and it had,
right.
It really almost had that opportunity to kind of like, it was right on the mainstream. A lot of these bands had major label deals and thousands of people were coming and it was generating such excitement. Like, I'm not exactly sure why Well, I mean, I have my theories on why it didn't connect in that way, where it went like truly haywire, like the Boston's or whatever. But at the time, that energy you're talking about, Maddie, was like, it was palpable. You could feel it in every room. It was
like crazy. Everybody wanted, like everyone I had ever met in New York, and was like, everyone was trying to be at the show. It was like guest list, everything crazy. You know, it was like, that moment was like, light the match. This shit is blowing up. And so that was super cool from that standpoint to see it like that. And I was like selling shirts as fast as my hands could move. And I'm like, oh my God, like, we might not have enough. Like, these guys have fucking windbreakers. Like, God damn, this is cool. You know, this dragon is everywhere. It's so fucking cool.
Did you actually ever see one of those guys like pull a Robert De Niro? Like something real smooth, real tough?
Oh, I seen a couple tough things and plenty of cool things. But
and Maddie participated with you, which I won't bring up in this particular setting because I don't know if about
statute of limitations.
Yeah. But let's just say one. Okay. I can do this without saying anybody's Christ. Names, but I went to see the Warped Tour first year. This is before, Lord. This was like a crappy,
this is nice. Let me tell 96. One other story before you tell that.
Go ahead. Yeah.
So, but when you ask about a singular moment, one that came before that show, my UPS man's here. I got to, nah, fuck him. The door's locked. He can just drive away. So big business. We were doing this Black Chain Jack opening slot for Sick of It All, and I got nothing. All right, we're good.
That's Ernie at the door. What are you saying?
What is going on? What are you doing? And we're making our way back from the Midwest, Kansas, somewhere. And Black Chain Jack had this like short bus, converted short bus, and we drove in and slept in it, and seemed like a great idea. Never is. Never any band, anyone who listens to this, do not buy a small school bus and think it's a good idea to tour.
That's your kiss of death, Benny.
Forget it.
They show up in those short yellow buses. Yeah, you know,
they'll be staying at your house after that. Fucking not. That thing needs a rear main seal and fucking and brake shoes every minute. So we're like the St. Louis and these Clevelands and these fucking misbegotten Midwestern places. And it's December, so it's cold as fucking can be. And Sick of It All has a tour bus. And, you know, I'm driving this thing all night. Like, you know, you take off and you're like, I'm going to follow the bus as far as we can and shit. So after a couple nights, we were positioned to stay in some city, Pittsburgh or Cleveland. And it was like -9 degrees. Ooh. And so this guy from Sick of It All, who barely knew me from fucking anybody, said, come in the hotel. We have one room in the hotel and everyone else is going to stay in the bus. Come in the hotel if you want to get a shower or whatever. And then do not sleep in that van. You got to sleep in the bus. And I was like, oh no, I'm prepared. Like I'm from New Jersey and I'm tough and I have like a real deal sleeping bag. Like I'll be fine. Mm-hmm. And they're like, no, everyone in your guys, the band guys, everyone, we're staying, four of us are staying in the hotel or five of us are staying in the hotel, sleep in the bus. And I was like, all right, these guys they know Ernie, they know those guys better than me and shit. I was like, they just invited me into their home.
Yeah. You know,
and we're like, we're concerned you'll be a fucking frozen New Jersey third ass popsicle by tomorrow. And so that moment very, very, very early in our time was poignant and mattered to be like, wow, these guys, they have the goatees and the whole thing. And you know, it's clobbering time, but now it's time to come inside and actually be warm and not freeze to death.
So it's like Robert De Niro at the end of Meet the Parents.
It was very, very, softened up, you know, took a moment. So it was very kind that they were, you know, they were, you suddenly got to see, like, these are human beings who are very thoughtful. All the stage stuff is, you know, and all the hardcore is music and everything. They're like, you're going to fucking freeze in that piece of shit yellow bus. You're going to freeze. I don't care. Get in the van, get in this other bus, come in, have a slice of Domino's pizza and then just,
wow. See, they never gave me any pizza.
Well, I was fortunate. I was good work ethic, was fortunate to be offered a piece of pizza
Dave, you didn't get to that point.
That was his soul's thing. That one of the selling points, Pete Steinkopf goes, look, man, come over, work for us. We'll give you $300 a week raise, and we're going to share the pizza. Yeah. I can't believe those guys don't share the pizza. Yeah. That was an actual thing that was said to me, as if I needed any reason to call Maddie and go, hey, should I work for these guys? Like that $300 more dollars a week was 85% raise.
And
I just thought, yeah, but these guys are the kings of hardcore, man. He's like,
In most of my life, I've been fortunate to showed up at the right time for certain things. And they were, they were just, you know, this record was selling. They were touring, you know, the label was supporting it. There was a bus, the shows were fucking packed. Like, there was enough pizza to go around. You know, it was
Lou gave me some pizza. Yeah, I'll be honest. Yeah. Lou did give me some
pizza.
You had to
endure a mild hassle, but you would get it.
No, here, kid, here.
All right. Well, this is a very positive story I enjoyed. But give me this Warped Tour story.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Now I'm not going to name any names, but I will say that I was okay. I'm 18, 17. I'm at the Warped Tour. I'm there for Quicksand. I'm there for Sick of It All. I'm there for the Goats.
Is that that show?
And I'm there for, remember it was in the Camden parking lot or whatever, of the Tweeter Center. Christ. And there's a man in the pit who's clearly from somewhere in Pennsylvania that's not Philadelphia.
Okay.
And he's about, to me, he's 9 foot tall, so he probably was only 6 foot.
Some Bethlehem type.
10 foot. He was unbelievably big and strong and tattooed with various white power kind of, you know, tats. He's one of these guys. And you're like, you know, when you're my size, you're like, oh, I thought we were going to get in the pit for Sick of It All and have a good time.
No.
And this guy is beating the shit out of everyone. Right. And not only was he, you know, big and strong, but he was clearly filled with hate. You know, he's a guy, it's a skinhead guy or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I'm crumbed. I'm trying to do my moves that I learned from the Sick of It All video.
One foot up, two feet down. Yeah.
That's right. The various floor punches and things. Well, I'm just getting mowed over and all my friends are getting mowed over. So I kind of retreat a couple rows back and watch Sick of It All just lay waste in New Jersey. And I'm recovering from my various dances over as they finish up, right? And this man is menacing around. You know, he's like looking for whatever next fight he can get into. Well, as if they're not the most wonderful hardcore band filled with vim and vigor, amazing songs, amazing performance, great goatees, beautiful, big muscles, right?
Handsome, athletic.
One of the gentlemen who was just playing the show, which will go unnamed, and one of his henchmen jump off the stage and deliver a vicious beating to this giant.
Wow. Yeah.
So you're there to see your favorite band. You have a little bit of a bummer by this big white power goon. And these guys bring street justice to this man.
This was
right in front of you. And I'm going, of course, in my mind, I'm thinking they saw what we saw. This mean bully in the pit who is menacing people, and he's white power. So they just decided to take matters into their own hands. This is truly a New York hardcore institution. These guys are street justice, and they're doling it out exactly to the right guy. Well, obviously, there's a whole backstory. This guy had beat up some friend of theirs or girlfriend or whatever. I learned all this later when I worked for him because I told this story to the band and to our you know, our guest here on the podcast today. Did you have anything to do with that? I mean, one of them pulled out a rubber hose and beat this man about the head and chest. It was so fucking cool to me as a 16-year-old, 17-year-old kid. kid, whatever I was. And then I, you know, obviously when you work for them, you see all kinds of crazy shit. There's people getting beaten up. There's tons of stories like that, but that was one for me.
No, there's not tons of stories like that.
Stories. I'm not, story. Who knows what's true, yeah. Right? And who, but this I saw with my own eyes. I can't exactly remember which band member it was. I definitely can't remember which guy. Crew member went down with him with the rubber hose. I can't quite recall who that was either, but I will say it was such a glorious doling out of punishment.
There was that incident. Like,
so, go ahead, take a breath.
So growing, we've covered most of my early life. And so if I was a boxer, my professional fight record at this point was like, had to be like 0-16. And so now I've been indoctrinated in this with the Kings from Queens of New York hardcore my professional fight record was now 1-16 because after some festival skirmish in Europe, and I was like emboldened, like, yo,
yeah, feeling good. Yeah.
Like if we got a fight, like I can fuck some people up, you know? And so there was an incident, a previous incident, and it had led to some grief and like the show ended, whatever those things were, like 30-minute sets ended.
Yeah. Right.
And then Pete handed me the guitar and Craig handed me the bass, and I was putting them, you know, to the side to like get our crap off the stage. And someone said, the gentleman Dave described is here and we're going to kill him. And the next thing out of any of the band members' mouth was, are you coming? And I put those guitars down and said, yeah. Like, yeah. Right,
sure.
Fuck yeah. Like, I'm coming.
Want to keep your and job.
Does anyone have a length of hose?
Yeah. Yeah. Luckily, a man who worked on the drum tech position was able to find a very, very strangely put in a Camden parking lot piece of PVC pipe. and feel free to edit any of the shit out. But
oh, it's your liability, not ours.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. What was the name of what was the address of my company again? right. So exactly. This was a real scuffle that it ended poorly for the gentleman and that was a heavy situation. And it's interesting that Dave can have seen that from the spectator's eyes, because I saw it.
I was standing over that guy like Chris Tucker, like when he got picked up by the band and the crew. I was like, "Damn, you got the fuck out!" You
know? Yeah.
I was so pumped.
There was a lot because
I thought you guys were just doing us a favor. Like, oh, we really are with the crowd.
Yeah, that's this some altruistic superhero shit in you.
Yeah, this is
yes.
Yeah, like yes. I mean, someone said it's actually clobbering time now, and it happened. So
it was like everything you thought about the band.
Yeah,
you know, as a Philadelphia hardcore fan came true in that one moment. Maddie, do you, we can leave the story at that, because the questions I have for you are probably better off
I think that they're better off. Actually,
well, liability is a thing.
Listen, you know? We're like, 90 minutes into going off track.
Yeah.
If people are still hanging on to every word by now, you got a lawyer on the horn or something. If you need, you guys are fine.
If I need to plead the fifth, I can. Go ahead. What do you got?
Well, I mean, there was fallout from that, right?
Yeah.
Like, weren't they like not invited back to the Warped Tour for some years?
There was fallout in terms of possible legal. There was a lawsuit. There was.
Right.
There was questions of whether assault charges would be filed. There
would have been 1,000 witnesses saying it never happened.
Of course.
Every punk rock kid from Philly and Jersey that was there was so pumped to see that goon take his beating.
Probably just alongside of your Ambler ass right there, Roxborough, was a kid from fucking Maniunk with a camera snapping away at this incident. Some months later, a I guess faxed copy of photographs, you know, come through. Like,
we should have thrown them in the schuylkill.
Yeah, there was another. There was some justice directed his way as well. It was a real. I'll keep that.
Just took a racketeering charge. Shit.
Yeah. But the band had a legal problem with that. And this man was a villain. He was a true villain. Not a good person. This was a street justice situation, but the band paid a price for it with
cash.
And those big dumb pricks always sue. Yeah. You know.
Yeah, you're right.
Like, you're all tough until you take one.
And so funny, I can give you two more stories that I can tell better than that. One is real short. We were working in. We were at the familiar with the PWAC in Long Island.
Yeah, yeah, I remember.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So Sick of It All was doing a show. Maybe we were just doing a quick weekend gig or some shit, and we're out there. And a guy was giving Lou a rough time. I'm sure he was high on LSD or some shit, but he's constantly, you know, grabbing at Lou in a bad way, yeah. And you're like, you do your roadie, you know, wife beater walk over there and be like, kind of push the guy a little bit, like, yo, fuck off, man, yeah. Chill. And, he adjusted your chain wallet after. And so, but this guy's mental. Something's wrong with him. And so Lou kind of gives a look to the side, like, yo. And I was like, this guy's like grabbing, fuck him, you know, fuck him. This guy has to get dealt with. And so I grabbed him and our drum tech TS, we grabbed him and yanked him from the crowd, ranked him up onto the stage and then dragged him to the back and, you know, dealt with it. Not a big beating or anything, but quickly dealt with. Like, the guy realized he was in problem area. Now he was behind the stage with two guys that were ready to punch his face in. And threw him out the back door. And Stormy Shepherd, legendary Stormy Shepherd, yeah, yeah, of Leave Home Booking, was at the show, who had always booked Sick of It All. And at the end of the night, we're loading the gear, and she's like,
oh, yeah.
Who's fucking... If there's
Saint Stormy.
The definition of nice times 100, it's Stormy. And she was like, I'm so proud of you. I'm so proud of you guys, the way you just dealt with that. Like, and I was like, oh, oh man, that's better. Like, I guess, you know, good to not jump off the stage with both feet under the guy's head and all such things, you know, like, which is not my nature and stuff. And so I was like, oh man, we did it right. Like, Stormy, a nice person approved of what we did. Like, we did something right. And this won't be a problem and shit. So that was one instance where the justice was obviously when you get a kid from Buffalo and a kid from Jersey, you know, the justice dial is way down from like 10.
Right.
So another watershed moment for me was we were in Europe, we were in England, and all through the Scratch the Surface period, Sick of It All was very, very, always had been very popular in Europe, very popular all over Europe and England, and had was MTV exposure, and to the point that people bootlegged the t-shirts and would show up and sell bootleg t-shirts outside the show. Mm. And this had happened in Berlin, where MAD, Mark's booking agency, was, So a couple guys threw a table up in Berlin on some previous tour and were selling bootleg Sick of It All t-shirts. And they ran into some of Berlin's finest heavy hitters. And quickly, street justice was done upon them and sent them home to wherever. No one knew really where they were from, but broken and bruised and to not... Do not be fucking around selling fake merchandise outside of the Sick of It All show.
Wow. Yeah.
So some months later, different tour. We're doing a show in Manchester, England. Civ and H2O are on the tour with us, and they're on a different bus. And it was at a university up high, like the fourth floor, rec room of some university. Dick Dale was playing on the third floor on the same night.
Nice.
It was kind of a weird mix of people around. So we're packing up the show. The show just ends, packing up the gear, and someone comes over to from a window and says, like, hey, those kids outside are smashing the bus.
Oh.
And we're like, oh, fuck. Like, and then, you know, a couple people go running off. And, you know, so there's extra element of New York hardcore guys there from the other bands and shit. And Lou was there, and he's like, yo, break down the gear. Something's up. It's these t-shirt bootleggers are here. There's a whole slew of them. They're going to try to fuck us up. Break down all the gear, get all the gear sorted out. So we hustle through that and get everything kind of packed. And then, you know, people are running in different directions and shit. And so as the road crew, we were finally like, yo, fuck this, man. If shit's going down, we're going down swinging. So we go downstairs through this, pushed our way downstairs and outside where the bus is parked. And now the show is over. So there's like 400 or 500 kids scattered about. And there's a real air of chaos, like borderline riot. You know? And you can't tell who's who and what's going on. There's like there's random piles of t-shirts like on the ground and big piles of posters and shit. And so, you know, you're getting these, like, someone's yelling, like, you know, Pete yelling to you, like, these fucking bootlegger fucks tried to throw the fucking through the bus. And you're like, fuck these guys, you know, let's fuck them up. And so we're like running up to everyone who's there and like grabbing a hold, like, who the fuck are you? And the kid's like, oh man, I love the band, man. I was at the show. And you're like, all right, get out of here. You know, you're like sorting everyone out into like who's the enemy and shit. And it turns out these guys had come prepared, you know, they showed up out in front of the show, bunch of bootleg shit, 10 or 12 dudes, ski masks, a couple guys with bats.
Yeah.
They were trying to bash in the windows of the bus, which ended up being Civ and the H2O bus. And somebody had gotten alerted and was like, oh, these guys are like, they're like fucking with the bus tires and trying to break the windows and shit. And, the early troops had gone out the front door, Craig, Pete, and Smokey from H2O, Smokey who played bass in H2O, from Zero Tolerance. And so they had like delved into the crowd and ran up to the boot. Like Pete Cole was running up to these guys with armfuls of t-shirts. Like, give me the fucking shirts, you know? And it's like, so it's like having a pit bull right in your face, right, you know? Right. And these kids, so these guys, some of these guys are like dropping the shirts and running away. And Pete scoops up the shirts and runs inside. And then Craig has a fucking mic stand, and this guy comes at him with a baseball bat with a ski mask on.
Whoa.
And they're doing like a full on Darth Vader fucking lightsaber battle.
Yeah, yeah.
Toby knocked the guy out, and Smokey's just walking up to everyone. He's wearing Dickie shorts, no shirt, and probably been drunk for 3 days, walking up to anyone. It's like, who are you? Like, it's like, are you fucking mad? We're sick of it all, and dropping people left and right and shit. So it
sounds like gangs in New York.
It was a mayhem. And so we get there a little bit late, and guys are kind of running away, and some people running towards us, and there's a big bin of giant English beer bottle, recycling beer bottles, huge, and I'm like, fuck, grab this, you know. Like TS has a hi-hat stand in his arm and I'm like right by me and Pete Cole are like side by side. I'm like, oh, we're like running into battle. And, this guy with a ski mask points at us and he goes, you're fucking dead, mate. You're fucking dead. And I throw this beer bottle and it hits the guy dead in the chest, and, you know, from like 40 feet away.
Good shot.
Knocks him to amazing. Like none of this should never happen again. It hits him, like he falls to the ground and he gets up and he's like a little shocked and he goes, you're fucking dead, mate. And he's putting the finger, like making his gun in his fingers into a gun and pointing it at his temple. He's like, you're fucking dead. And I just see Pete windmill his fucking arm, like Nolan fucking Ryan. And this bottle hits the guy so hard upside the head. Bang. Like his feet come unglued, comes off the ground, like bang, you know? And then we're just running forward. Like, and you could, now it's all sorted out. Like the kids are off to the side and the bootleggers are running for the hills, and us and Civ's crew and H2O are throwing bottles and kicking it. If anyone stumbled, they're getting their ass kicked and shit. And we're scooping up like dozens and dozens of bootleg t-shirts and posters of 300 posters in the street. And then, so the whole thing ends.
So you guys are stealing the bootleg shit.
Yeah. Stole it all back. Dude, we gave it away to all the kids that were at the show. Like, we're like, anyone who wants a shirt, you can have a shirt.
Anyone who helped in the beatdown.
Anyone who got a shirt. anyone who got punched by accident. Yeah. Like, you know, and so the cops show up and, you know,
the Bobbies.
Yeah. English. And they're like, all right, what's happened here now? And we're like, oh, these guys were bootlegging t-shirts. But all of our fans from the show knew that was bullshit. So they kind of rioted and beat them all down and chased them out. And the guy's like, so these cops are like, you understand that the t-shirt bootleggers are run by organized crime.
Yeah.
And Manchester is the home base of this operation.
Right.
And whatever's happened to you will not end tonight. And we're like, oh, really? Like, they must have sent the fucking junior varsity or something. Like, and these cops are like, you have to leave town. Where are you going? Where's your next show? Like, you're going to need a police escort. Like, these guys will come. These maniacs, hooligans will come and fuck with you, you know? And so
it's like Peaky Blinders are going to be after.
We're going straight into like fucking the bad guys from Snatch, you know, these marble mouth, gun toting English. And so suddenly we're like, oh, I guess we better take this seriously, you know. And so the cops are like, pack up your gear, get in. We'll drive you to the hotel. We'll drive with you. Cops will come with you to the hotel. Like, and then you should call the hotel where you're staying tomorrow and go there early and make sure that you can, you know, maybe they have a security guard or you can have a cop park by the bus at the venue, like this whole fucking thing. And we were like, wow, these guys came to Berlin and got their arms broken. And then they tried to come for revenge with baseball bats and ski masks. And they got whooped again. As they're the soupiest organized crime motherfuckers I ever heard of. I was like, we were bouncing beer bottles off their heads, you know, and all this shit. I was like, all right. And then, you know, the rest of everything proceeded without incident, like the next couple shows in England.
Yeah.
And so, but then like years later when Chunks was working with Green Day and stuff, and I was like, oh, you ever deal with this teacher? He's like, oh, we have a guy. The Green Day hires a guy to deal with them.
Oh, like an insider?
Whoa. Like a crazed cowboy that shows up in a fucking Cadillac and then like lifts up the carpet in the trunk and there's, you know, four machine guns and shit. And I'm like, whoa, how do you get a guy like that in England? You know, and he's like, this is a serious thing. Like, you know, like that bootlegging goes on and the people that do it are bad news. And so you hire a professional and he goes around and you know, protects the situation. And I was like, damn, we fucking got the little league version of that, you know?
Yeah. By the way, you know what, you know, the funny irony about this is you guys are risking life and limb fighting off t-shirt bootleggers in a parking lot in Manchester, wherein you could be killed. Right. You're in a foreign country. Yeah. And then all the while you're on a major label.
This is basically
stealing from you every single day, every single minute.
They're
stealing money.
Yeah. This is the way our brains work. You know?
Yeah, right. Like, well, let's take down. We're gonna. These guys could make a whole $1,000 off of us.
Yeah, I gotta say, totally. Robert De Niro might have figured out a way to work with them. You know,
that's right.
Tell you what, these guys, and they like whoever went out the fucking door of the club first, and these guys were there, and someone said, you know, they're like the guy with the bat and the mask. He's like, tell Sick of It All, they're fucking dead tonight, man. They're fucking dead, you know. And someone like ran in and was like, these guys, no, oh my God, you know, and those guys barged out the front door like fucking gangbusters, man. Craig ended up Craig was in the lightsaber battle with the guy and he ended up Smokey was making a run back for the door of the club after dropping about two or three guys. And Craig caught him out the corner of his eye at the last second, didn't realize it was Smokey. And he hit Smokey with the mic stand.
Oh, no.
And Smokey got his arm up at the last second. So it hit him on like the inside of his bicep. And for like the next 3 days, his arm turned different colors. Oh, and he's like, fucking Craig, hit me with the thing. You know, the thing. He's like, we were in fucking battle. We were heated in battle, you know. my reflexes are not. Look, you come at me from nowhere. I'm doing a sword fight, kid.
I guess the bystand was a useful weapon. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm doing a sword fight.
You know, and so this was like, yeah. And so, you know, you went from minute to minute. Like, that this could happen.
Let me give you a highlight of how tough that is, because I had a similar experience. Gasly was playing a show in, I want to say Bristol, because it was somewhere we hadn't been too much. And the same exact thing. Like, I had seen some funky people around the front of the venue, and then I was taking a walk and I saw a bunch of people setting up shit outside.
Yeah.
And I go inside and I'm like, yo, rally up. Like, we got to go.
Street justice.
Like, yeah. Like, we got to go talk to these dudes. Like, that's fucked up. Like, you know, and quickly someone from the venue was like, yo, you don't want to mess with the people selling your shirts. Like, you're better off just like letting it go. Like, you don't want that kind of trouble. And of course I'm like, oh, all
right. Right. Yeah.
So that's where it ended for me. That's why Sigmarol is a lot tougher. Come on, than I am.
Benny, you didn't get a mic stand and a high stand.
I did not. I just continued on with my night.
Rosamilia looks over from the bong hit that he's taking.
He pulled the drawstrings on his hood a little bit tighter and said, if we have to go to battle, I'm ready. Sleaze, get sleaze, you know?
We had a couple battlers, but. We didn't get a chance. I could never find them when I needed it.
It was a bizarre, you know, these things just happen in bizarre.
It's too
ways.
Funny, man.
It's interesting though, because like you kind of came from like the last era, because like with Green Day and all those bands making punk super popular, you know, mainstream or whatever, like you come from the era right before then,
yeah.
Right? It was still all that stuff was uncharted and dangerous, right. and still kind of like, you know, not there was no roadmap by the time.
The way, still.
The time Gaslight or anything we did, you know, I've done or the loved ones or whatever, like most of that stuff had been ironed out. Like you had somebody at the venue who would say, "Hey, there's going to be bootleggers, just let it ride."
Right.
But like you guys were pioneers in that way, and Maddie, you worked for a bunch of pioneering kind of bands. Yeah. As the scene went from this like niche thing into you know the center of whatever it was, the zeitgeist.
Yeah. Maybe your experience is the reason I did not fight the English mob. So
yeah,
totally.
So and I mean, I just got lucky. Like I said, my good fortune and timing collided in my life.
Thanks to you for being the person that we can all call about 8 hours before we need anything. And you'll be like, yeah, sure, no problem.
Totally.
I'll ruin my night, but don't worry, I'll get it taken care of for you.
Maddie, I need 36 Ben Franklin.
Love you guys. Maddie, thanks, man.
Love to you all. Thanks for having me.
Hey, it was good to chuckle it up.
Oh, boy.
My goodness, Brad.
If you're sick of it all, fan, go back and listen to the episode that we did with Lou and Pete. I mean, I thought that episode had some real revelations.
Yeah.
But dude, no way. Didn't touch Maddie's stories.
I can't believe
it anyway, though.
Listen, I saw the exact people that Sick of It All took on. Like I said in that story.
Yeah.
Same situation happened to me. I scoped it out. I saw it. And I mean, it's fascinating that they took it on. It's just a hands-on approach. This is what makes people from Queens unique and special. Okay. So I'm half a Queens person. This is why. But it was spicy, Brad.
It was very spicy.
Get it? Perfect segue.
You're a good segueer.
Thank you.
Segueer.
Speaking of spice,
if you like us and you like hot food,
that's right. This episode of Going Off Track was brought by Silk City Hot Sauce, a fine hot sauce company from southern Vermont who uses locally grown peppers to make their hot sauces. Nothing but good organic ingredients. Awesome rock and roll pulp art labels. Just the kind of thing we can get behind. And the hot sauce is delicious. So if anyone would like to place an order for hot sauce and get a free bottle of it and 15% off, you can use our promotional code GOT at silkcityhotsauce.com.
Yeah, baby.
Mm.
Love that.
Besides for that, we got some fun stuff coming up. And I don't know.
Well, and I should say that this interview was about twice as long as what you heard. If you are, if you find that you are now a Maddie fan, or if you were a Maddie fan before, or probably if you're a Bouncing Souls fan, you need to become a patron at least long enough to hear the bonus material, because there's basically a whole bonus episode from this one, and it's patreon.com/goingofftrack. You can hear it there, but you do have to contribute. It'll be worth it, though.
Yeah. Thanks to Maddie for taking the time. Thanks for Dave for being a good sport and jumping on with us.
Oh, yeah. Thanks so much.
Thanks to all of you for listening to the program. We appreciate it.
Yeah. Leave us a, you know, review on iTunes. If you're listening to Benny, he'll tell you to make it saucy.
What he means by saucy is sexually explicit. And I think the music from the band Silk Sonic that's been coming out is sort of paving the way for people to be overtly sexual again, wearing silk covered in oils, doing things the way things should be done. You know what the world needs these days, Brad? It needs romance. Oh, it needs sexiness.
Yeah, baby.
Everything's so cold. Everything's so black and white. You know what I like? I like the saucy red middle of things. That's what I like.
Juicy. So be juicy and leave us a review on iTunes.
That's right. Every time you do, I'll do this Eddie Murphy laugh.
And, you know, follow us at Going Off Track on Instagram and Twitter. That's always a big help. Let's get those numbers up, man. Become a follower.
Yeah, follow us. And be a follower.
I think we're going to do this again sometime, aren't we, the Road Dogs? Because I know I want to hear
stories. No, there's some great people out there that I've sat in the back of buses with or shared a beer with or spent some time with that can spin some fucking yarns for you, man. The people behind the scenes, they see it all. They see it all and can usually take a more honest approach to the stories anyway, you know?
Let us know if you like this kind of thing, because we like doing it, and it's just, you know, can't always have a huge star on, I don't think. I think there's a lot of stories in this business that are better told by those behind the scenes.
Yeah, let's take a week off from fucking guitar tones and shit, you know? Yuck.
All right.
All right. See you later. Thanks, everyone.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.